This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Happy Friday, everyone, and thanks for joining us. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with immigration and law enforcement and Attorney General Jeff Sessions' visit to New Hampshire yesterday. Sessions was there to announce new efforts to combat the opioid addiction crisis, and he took aim at the city of Lawrence, Massachusetts.
Prosecutors have brought charges recently against some 50 people involved in distributing fentanyl, including four illegal aliens residing in the sanctuary city of Lawrence, Massachusetts. And there can be no sanctuary for drug dealers and fentanyl dealers in this country.
The mayor of Lawrence took issue with the way Sessions characterized his city and says he might sue the AG for libel. Mayor Dan Rivera says Lawrence has not and will not harbor criminals, documented or undocumented. Sessions' visit came as the Trump administration's immigration policies face another challenge in federal court in Boston.
This isn't about the law. It's about Trump and his efforts to deport immigrants of color.
Also this week, the administration says it's complying with the first part of a court order to reunite some of the migrant children separated from their parents at the border. That's why it's taking so long. President Trump suggested responsibility for the family separation crisis that his administration created lies elsewhere.
Well, I have a solution. Tell people not to come to our country illegally. That's the solution.
All right. To discuss that solution and others and the rest of the week's news, we have Susan Tracy, president of the Democratic consulting firm The Strategy Group. She's also a former state rep. Hey, Susan.
Hello, Anthony.
Good to see you. And with us as well, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, great to have you.
It's good to be with you.
So let's start with Attorney General Sessions in New Hampshire. He was there to say that he wants to bring charges against anyone suspected of dealing fentanyl. He's in Maine today. He also made that connection between illegal immigration and the opioid crisis. Susan, is that a connection that he should be making? Is there validity to that connection?
Well, should be making. No. I mean, everything is about trying to disparage immigrants, finding a hook to, I think, justify some of their really bad behavior around immigration. And here's another example. Look, I think we all agree the opioid crisis is horrible. You know, fentanyl deaths are on the rise. You know, we're all there, but this demonizing of people is not going to make this a better place or not going to solve this problem. It's really frustrating.
Jim, what's your take on this? Because this is something that the Trump administration comes to back to again and again and again, and his supporters eat it up, this idea that this is why you need strong borders, because drugs are pouring into the country.
Well, you know, I take what Susan said and said the demonization piece of this is what's problematic. So if you're demonizing people with a sort of a broad brush, it's a huge issue. To say that fentanyl's not coming through the border is probably not factual, but also it comes through a lot of other places, too. So to lay all the blame on the lack of a border wall, or to take that even five steps further and say we need to demonize people, that's a big problem. I think a lot of people who support Trump in this take the view that it's a question of the rule of law. And while that's a respectable perspective, the fact is the treatment of refugees is also a matter of rule of law, too. So, you know, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that, because that's another issue that I want to move on to, and that is this issue of family separations, why it's taking so long to reunite these families. The administration has already missed one deadline. My understanding is, I think as of today, they're 2 days past a deadline where they reunited about 50-something kids with their families. So here's Chris Meekins, the Health and Human Services Department, speaking to reporters on Tuesday, stressing that his agency must continue, is trying to follow strict protocols, including DNA testing of children and families before reuniting them.
Each step of our process is necessary to protect children. Eliminating any one of these steps will endanger children.
All right. So, Jim, obviously a really complicated situation of matching these children with their parents, DNA testing. But of course, this is all to resolve a whole lot of confusion that was created by the Trump policy in the first place. What do you make of this?
Completely agree. The one thing I would say is if you take a look at the under five population, that's the 103 kids they're dealing with. Yeah. 57 of them were reunited to their parents. That means 46 were not. And the reasons are not fully known to us. They put into a set of categories that include people. These are kids who are not actually with their parents.
Yeah,
these could be loved ones. They could be uncles. They could be aunts. They could be human traffickers. And we just don't know. And I guess I really want people to start talking from facts. So I'd like to know what the heck this looks like on the other side of that, because 46 kids that are not categorized yet is a lot out of 103.
Yeah. Susan, what do you make of this?
Well, I'd like to start talking from why did they do this in the first place? They, you know, started criminalizing immigrants crossing the border, breaking up their families, using kids as political pawns with no policy or plan for how they were ever going to reunite people. So I kind of get frustrated with talking about, well, we've got 46 people, and to Jim's point, you know, some facts, some not, to try to zero in on perhaps one situation where there's maybe an issue with the parent or not. But the reality is why did we do this in the first place? Why did we break up these families? We're not supposed to do that. And I sort of almost don't even want to talk about this granular issue. I want to focus on the absurdity and horror of the policy in the first place.
It's interesting. I think in another era, a story like this I would have probably stayed on the front page for a really long time, and we would have been talking about it. But in this era of the Washington chaos machine, and here we are talking about the possible end of NATO and beating up on allies in Britain, but no, now everything is perfect. I mean, it's just one kind of chaotic moment after another. A story like this, where we're talking, as you suggest, about children being ripped away from their parents, it like falls away.
Yeah, it's too much. I think all of us have had the conversation of just when you think you've sort of hit the bottom, it's lower again when these things happen. I've never seen anything quite like this.
Mm. Well, sort of not heeding my own warning, I need to move on to some other stories. Also this week, two cases in Boston federal court involving immigration. The first is a plea from a Brazilian mother living in Massachusetts to be immediately reunited with her 9-year-old son. The pair had been separated for almost 2 months after crossing the U.S.-Mexican border. The other case is a challenge to the Trump administration's decision to terminate temporary protected status for a group of immigrants from Haiti, El Salvador, and Honduras. They were allowed to live here without fear of deportation, but the administration now says that they no longer need humanitarian protection because conditions in their home countries have improved. Their advocates were in court yesterday calling the policy racially motivated because it affects largely immigrants of color. Jim, I know two cases, they're related, but sort of take a whack at either one of these or both of these in any way you can. What do you
make? Let me take on the temporary protected status piece, and then let me just go back to what Tracy was saying before. I think we often get into this thing of sort of we've been conditioned by Facebook, either we like or we dislike. The fact is, these are heinous policies, but also I don't think we should turn our heads from facts. And those are some of the facts I was trying to get at before. In this case, the fact is that the Trump administration is like a carpenter who has a hammer and a nail and thinks everything deserves a hammer and a nail to advance its own interests. The TPS stuff, the temporary protected status stuff, is clearly treating people sort of in a utilitarian way to gain leverage. And that is what Trump does all the time with NATO, with immigrants. Everything is to gain leverage. And what he's trying to do is to split, in essence, the folks who are advocates for legal immigrants from those who are advocates for illegal or undocumented immigrants.
Yeah. Right. Susan?
Yeah. And we're playing this game, and there are over 250,000 kids of these immigrants who are in our country who will be separated from their parents if they're sent back. We have the Department of Homeland Security who has issued warnings not to travel to those countries because they're dangerous, while we have the president saying there's no problem there anymore. And we have the diplomats from those countries saying, don't do this. This is going to cause chaos there. So to Jim's point about facts, all of the facts point to not making this decision. And the callousness of sort of discarding all of those kids and families and doing it in contradiction to two U.S. agencies, to what end?
Hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll leave that question hanging there. Let's move on to another national story with big local impact, and that is President Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to succeed retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. Kavanaugh currently serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He teaches at Harvard Law. So here's Judge Kavanaugh Monday night after President Trump introduced him.
My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written. informed by history and tradition and precedent.
So before I bring you two in on this, we got some local reaction. We spoke to Ron Cass. He's Dean Emeritus of Boston University School of Law, who knows Judge Kavanaugh personally. Here's what he said.
He's very thoughtful, very measured, and very committed to following precedent and to obeying the law and to seeing that the law is interpreted and applied in a reasonable and predictable way.
So Senate Republicans are promising a swift confirmation process, while Democrats, who are outnumbered in the Senate, as we know, are promising to oppose him. So here's a bit of what Elizabeth Warren told us. She's worried that Kavanaugh's confirmation could lead to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the Affordable Care Act. She's also worried about this.
He has written an article saying, in effect, that presidents like Trump should be above the law. They should not be subjected to investigations. I want you to think about that. Not the kind of investigation that Richard Nixon was subjected to, that Bill Clinton was subjected to. No, that presidents are above the law.
So, Susan, I'll start with you. And Elizabeth Warren there is referring to some writings that Kavanaugh did in 2009, 3 years after Bush appointed him to the D.C. Circuit Court, where he basically, I mean, the argument was basically presidents are too busy to get in, to be involved in criminal investigations and civil suits. But what's your overall reaction to this choice?
Two things. I mean, you know, I agree with Elizabeth Warren. I find a kind of an irony in his position on that, given that he was Ken Starr's assistant in the Whitewater investigation of Bill Clinton. So there's that. But put that aside. For me, there are two things that really concern me. One is the Heritage Foundation list, which is what he was chosen from, which Kavanaugh was chosen from. And I do ask myself, what did you have to do to get on the list, and what did you have to promise? And I think we should understand that. You know, why? Who is, you know, who's the group, and what did they tell people? But more importantly, I feel like the other thing that no one is talking about is the nuclear option. And that's what we have here.
You're talking about the majority vote in the Senate.
Absolutely.
As opposed to the 61 vote threshold.
Correct.
Right.
It's always been a 61 threshold. Now, I know that, you know, we'll go back and we'll say Harry Reid changed it. He did not change it for Supreme Court nominees. He changed it for cabinet positions and lower court positions because they were stalled. Probably the wrong choice. But to change this for Supreme Court nominees, which they did for Gorsuch and which they're going to do here, assures that we're always going to get extremely polarized members of the Supreme Court. And that is a real problem for our country. We are divided enough as it is. But to take that division and to just continue to hammer us deeper and deeper apart, I worry about that probably more than any specific issue in terms of moving forward and how we choose people who have lifetime appointments and have the final say on many policies in our society.
It's really interesting that you brought that up. And Jim, one of the things that Elizabeth Warren sort of said to me the other day when I was talking to her was, you know, Kavanaugh is not a consensus choice. And Susan's talking about the very issue that sort of makes it impossible to be a consensus
Absolutely.
Choice if we're just talking about a 51 vote majority. Interesting. What do you think?
Well, yeah, a consensus choice seems to be pretty hard when you can't get a justice approved, like Merrick Garland, right? And
yeah.
It just everything gets stalled out. So I think consensus is left. And one thing I just remind folks, people always say, well, after Bork got borked, as they said, you know, in I think it was 88 or 87.
This was Reagan's choice.
This was Reagan's choice.
Yeah.
They said, well, things have gotten a lot worse. And they have. But I would remind people that, you know, Nixon went through two different nominees before he got Harry Blackmun, right? So, I mean, it's not like this comes in waves. What I would say about this, about Kavanaugh, what I've read about him is he seems to be a very solid, scholarly judge with good temperament. I think that Ron Cass is using code word, trying to tell us not to worry about Roe v. Wade because he says, well, he follows precedent, right? I don't know all that.
Yeah.
I don't know all that. What I would say is I think he is, Akhil Reed wrote in the New York Times, you know, a liberal's case for Kavanaugh. He makes some really good points about his scholarship, his engagement in developing clerks and getting clerks who are actually on the working for Supreme Court justices, all that sort of thing. But what I would say is you don't really know. What's interesting about this in terms of the impact, what is interesting about the nominee is that every president who's wanted to skirt difficult situations has gone for someone with a thin resume, this fellow has a very thick resume.
Yeah, there's a lot to look at in terms of his legal writings. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
And I think that Jeff Jacoby's piece and just good government would require that he goes through a thorough vetting. Hmm. I would say that in terms of his own politics, it seems like he's somewhere between Kennedy and Gorsuch. Kennedy is a little more right-leaning than most people would like to say right now. They're saying, well, he's a middle guy. He's a middle guy in a right-leaning horde. And I think that that Kavanaugh will be that plus a little more towards Gorsuch.
So I have a question about Roe v. Wade, and I sort of want to set it up this way. So there's an interesting development on Beacon Hill. So House Speaker Robert Leo has said that the House plans on voting on a bill that would eliminate a series of antiquated laws, including one from 100 years ago that bans abortions. The law has been unenforceable because of Roe v. Wade, but it's still on the books. And given the changes on the Supreme Court, there's a bunch of state lawmakers on Beacon Hill that are moving to strike it from the books. The Senate has already done it. The House hasn't done it yet. But all of this, and I'll put this to you, Susan, sort of leads to this big question about Roe versus Wade and the possibility that a Justice Kavanaugh could lead to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. What do you think?
My fear on that would be if I don't know. Of course, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know if that will happen. But my fear would really be that there's this push to kind of do what you just say, which is to push this into the states.
Yeah.
And I think when you do that, you're just going to have very unequal opportunity for women and families and their medical choices across this country. And that seems to me probably where this would head. You know, Massachusetts will probably do, you know, protect Roe versus Wade, but that won't be true in every state. And so women will have unequal opportunity for health care in across the country. And that seems to be what I would fear the most.
Yeah. Final question. I mean, what are the Democrats to do here? I mean, I take your point, Susan, about the nuclear option, but the Democrats are still in a minority in the Senate. They're probably two or three red state Democrats that might well support putting Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. So what's the approach here? Is it just to sort of fall on their sword and go down fighting? But I mean, can they do anything? I guess I'll ask you this, Jim. I mean, can they actually do anything to prevent the Republicans getting their choice?
The Senate has frequently destroyed nominees. You could certainly destroy him in a way that Bork was, or that's, I mean,
to
you could
Bork
go after
him.
His, you can absolutely try to assassinate his character. I think a more profitable way that gets to substance is both Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, I think, have some real concerns about this. And Susan Collins has herself said, if I don't get some sort of, maybe not ironclad guarantee, but representations as to how he would treat precedent specifically related to Roe v. Wade, I don't know that I can actually support him. I don't know how that plays out, whether she's saying telling the truth or not, but I would actually play there first and see where you get with that. The problem is you do have folks like Joe Manchin who probably will vote for this candidate. So even if you lose one.
Yeah.
So,
Interesting dynamic. Okay, well, let's move on. I sort of brought us back to Beacon Hill there. So there are a few issues pending before the legislative session ends at the end of this month. So first issue, the Baker administration says it expects about a $1 billion revenue surplus for the fiscal year that ended June 30th, where about half the money is going to be deposited into the state's so-called rainy day fund. And today, the governor asked lawmakers to direct part of the surplus towards school safety, including hardening school facilities, hiring more social workers, and mental health professionals. Here's a bit of what he said about that.
We believe the resources are there, and we believe this package, based on the months of discussion that have taken place between folks on our teams and folks in local government, can make a positive difference in enhancing and improving school safety.
So, Susan, good use of the surplus, school safety?
You know, I feel like the first thing we have to do is get the budget in place before we can make decisions
right,
about
maybe
how
that's
to
where I should have started that. There is
the
no
surplus,
budget.
Right.
Yeah, right. There is no budget in place.
You know, hard for me to know what the issues are that are out there. You know, if we believe the governor, if he's been working with the legislature and it's something that that folks have put together, then, you know, I guess I'd believe him on his face on that.
Right.
But for me, I'm more focused on let's get the big budget done.
Right. So what about that, Jim? I mean, this comes at a time when Massachusetts is the last state in the country without a permanent spending plan for fiscal year 2019. The House and the Senate still have to reconcile differences in their two spending packages, right? What's up with that?
I think what's up with that is some real disagreement as to a couple of big issues. I would say on the education funding piece, this additional revenue is manna from heaven. It, by the way, did come through that tax cut. It's a one-time deal for the most part, I think. So spending it on new hires and that sort of thing, even if they're social workers and all the rest, you're going to have to carry that tail with you. So the question would be, do you put it more towards capital? Do you put it to things that are one-timers to some degree? One thing that's clear about the conversation about education funding, Anthony, is that the 1993 Education Reform Act grand bargain of reforms for revenue is dead in the sense that no one's talking about any more reforms. No one's talking about additional vocational technical schools. No one's talking about more school-based management. Forget the charters. This is just a straight out, let's go for more money. And there's no real conversation around what's driving up spending on the healthcare side or on the benefit side. It's just more money. So my gut is that Governor Baker probably doesn't get all that hardening. I think it's going to go towards the status quo.
Interesting. Susan, you're a former state rep, so give us some, I don't know, insight into what happens up there when you've got sort of the House and the Senate sort of taking too much time or needing more time to reconcile what's going on to come up with these. You're looking really skeptical.
I'm looking at you and thinking, none of this is new. I mean, this is what happens every year. I mean, this session ends on July 31st. Right. I know the budget was supposed to be done on July 1st, but they carry that over with, you know, 1/52nd budgets. And, you know, so the bills still get paid. It's not a Washington stoppage where the bills stop getting paid. It's classic horse trading, yeah. You know, and there are differences between the House and Senate, and the differences lie in the size of the body. You know, when you have 160 members on one side and you have 40 on the other, it's just inherently very different, right? You're going to have sort of more conservative power. You're going to have, I always say the power that you have as a legislator is not always the power to accomplish things, but the real power is the ability to stop things.
Right.
So you use your stopping ability as leverage to get what you want. It's horse trading. There's some policy differences, and I'm pretty confident that at 12:01 on July 31st, we'll have it all. Not everything done, but
all
a
right.
lot.
All right. So one quick thing before we leave Beacon Hill. One area where lawmakers acted before the deadline, automatic voter registration. The Senate unanimously passed a bill Thursday intended to encourage more participation in elections by enrolling voters when they interact essentially with the Registry of Motor Vehicles or Mass Health, unless they opt out. This sounds like a pretty good idea. Right, Jim?
You get a lot of people enrolled. Doesn't mean they're going to end up voting, but it gives them the opportunity to vote.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a fine thing.
Right. And we're seeing, Susan, a lot of examples of voter suppression laws around the country. This seems to go in exactly the opposite direction.
Yeah. When you saw the numbers with which those bills were carried in the House and Senate, you know there's a lot of support for doing this.
All right. So finally, let's move on to our hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week that maybe were below the fold. Jim, what's your hubbub this week?
Well, you know that it's Friday the 13th, right?
I hadn't even thought of that, but of course it is.
Of course it is. Well, you know, many of us have
Got 40 minutes of live programming left. I'm a little worried.
As I was driving here, I was looking behind, trying to see if the lightning was going to strike. You know, there are people like me who worry about that, but not the Philippine President Duterte. This week, one poll has him losing 11% of his support. As is evidenced by his execution of people on the streets. He doesn't really care terribly much about things like that. He's not worried about polls. His reaction was, I don't care. Make it 15%. It doesn't matter to me. He doesn't care about bad luck either. In a very Catholic country, he has called Pope Francis a son of you-know-what and called God even stupid. This week, he pledged to resign if anyone can prove that God exists. Now, that's a really good question, by the way. He mocked original sin as tainting innocent infants, and he ridiculed the clergy for having people pay to remove that original sin. At his most thoughtful, at a science and technology event, could you imagine him speaking at a science and technology event? Mm. He said, where is the logic of God? In a more relaxed mode, he exclaimed, who is this stupid God?
Good God.
According to that poll, he has seen his approval rating slip to around 65% to 70%, by the way.
Wow. Wow. Okay. How not to run a campaign in a country like that. Okay. Susan, you're...
Well, I'm not going to go the heathen route, but I find myself loving good stories these days and things that make me happy. And I think the happiest I was this week was when those boys came out of the cave in Thailand. I just felt like that was just a high. But for an incredible story within the incredible story. I was really taken by the boy, I'm going to hope I don't ruin his name here, Adul Samon, 14 years old, one of the players. He's from Wa, the state of Wa in Myanmar. He speaks five languages, English, Thai, Burmese, and Mandarin. And he was the one who, when they arrived, was able to speak English and say, you know, we're okay. And he worked with the Australian divers and helped them get out. And I just found, you know, and he's stateless, by the way, because he can't have a passport because he has no international status. And I just thought, like, wow, here's a wonderful story that has a wonderful story within it. And so many great stories in that story.
Well, that certainly was a rare bit of really good news. Okay, so I'm sort of along the same vein. It's summer. It's the weekend. So my hubbub has to be about the Red Sox and that incredible at-bat last night by Mookie Betts against the Toronto Blue Jays. Okay, so I'm sure most people know what happened, but we're going to play the tape because it's so much fun. So Red Sox down by a run in the fourth inning, bases loaded, two outs, full count. Betts keeps fouling off pitch after pitch, and then, well, here it is.
Three balls and two strikes. The count is full.
This will be the 13th pitch of the at-bat.
As the lefty comes home. Runners go, swing and a drive. Deep left field. It's a grand slam. Mookie Betts.
Okay, so that was pretty damn electrifying.
That was awesome. I watched that live, and I can keep listening to
that. It's really fun. But here's why this is my hubbub. Okay, so that wasn't exactly a hubbub. A lot of people paid attention to that. But this team is on a 10-game winning streak, 3.5 games in front of New York. Mookie Betts, J.D. Martinez, Chris Sale's unhittable. It seems like it's an extraordinary season in the making. I'm not sensing that people are really picking up on that yet. So I don't know. That's my hubbub. It's like this needs to be more than a hubbub. People need to get really excited about this team. So
I'm in.
That's my thought as we head into this weekend. Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
It's good to be with you.
And Susan Tracy, President of the consulting firm The Strategy Group and a former state rep, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Anthony.
Listeners, that's it. Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to have a few tips for staying safe in the water amidst a spike in drownings this summer. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.